As a child, Reina Grande dreamed of America. Then at 9 years of age, she was smuggled into the U.S. But life as an illegal immigrant and in the violent home of her father was anything but a dream come true. I'm Jabulani LaFault on today's Central Standard, a very compelling conversation with the author of The Distance Between Us, a memoir that tells a truly personal tale of a modern Mexican immigration experience. Hear about her early years left behind by her parents in Mexico and her journey to becoming a U.S. citizen. That's on the next Central Standard. Los Estados Unidos, nicknames and proper nouns abound for the many in the Spanish-speaking world who come, sometimes risking life and limb, to what they feel, know, and believe is the Great North, the other side, America. And there are many roads to travel, especially once an immigrant makes it to the other side of the border. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFault. And joining us now is Reina Grande, author of The Distance Between Us, a memoir about her journey from Mexico to the United States. Welcome to Central Standard, Reina.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Or should I say, bienvenidos.
Gracias.
Now, let's talk about your name. Let's start by talking about your name. Reina Grande. That's the direct traducción, big queen. Translation means big queen in English.
Yeah, someone once told me I'm an oxymoron.
Right.
Because my name means big queen, but I'm only 5 feet tall.
Right, right, right.
It's a hard name to grow up with, for sure. I got lots of laughs from kids. But it's a good writer's name, I think.
It is. And also very telling based on what you went through in The Distance Between Us, the memoir that you wrote, which is the subject of today's discussion. You're a novelist. What made you delve into your own life?
Well, my novels are very autobiographical, and I really love writing fiction because I get to use my imagination and make up characters and take them into different journeys. With the memoir, it was definitely a very difficult change for me because, you know, when you're writing a novel, you start from scratch. You don't have anything but just an idea. With the memoir, I had years and years and years of my life that I had to basically pick and choose from to tell a story. But I really wanted to write about this particular experience because, you know, it's something that was very close to my heart. And I wanted to write about what it was like for me as a child to be left behind in Mexico by both my parents. And I think that a lot of times when we speak about immigration, especially this year, you know, it's an election year and immigration is a hot topic. I think a lot of times, you know, we focus so much on the politics and the economics of immigration, but it's such a complex issue. And I wanted people to think more about the personal side, you know, of families and how they get affected by immigration.
This is definitely a very vivid first-person account, a human account of the larger immigration issue that you just touched on. And it has a narrative flow, almost as if it's creative nonfiction. Was that intentional?
Well, I think being a novelist, that's the way I approach the memoir. You know, I don't like to summarize. I don't like to narrate too much. I like to write in scene. I like to take my readers into the moment and let the characters reveal the story through their actions, through what they say. And each chapter, it's almost like a standalone story. You know, it's a glimpse of a day in my life.
And speaking of setting the scene, tell us about El Otro Lado. The other side. El Otro Lado, as both as a concept and the direct translation. What does that mean to you?
To me, when I was little, I was growing up in this little town in Mexico that was surrounded by mountains. And when people talked about that U.S., they always called it El Otro Lado, the other side. So to me, it was like, oh, it must be on the other side of the mountains. And for a long time, that's what I thought, that the U.S. was on the other side of the mountains. And I didn't know that it was 2,000 miles away. And then, you know, it also means a lot more in terms of your economic status, you know, because it could mean you live on this side of poverty, which is the poverty that we grew up in. And then El Otro Lado is the other side that you might never get to, you know, in terms of being able to aspire to something better. And in Mexico, this was the case. You know, there was no possibility of hope, of wishing for something better, because we were born into poverty, and I always thought that that's how I would die.
There's also a sort of mystical component to the other side, El Otro Lado, that you hear about as a kid. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I touch upon very early, like in the prologue, was I compared El Otro Lado to La Llorona. And, you know, La Llorona is the weeping woman who roams the rivers looking for her kids, whom she drowned. And she was condemned to search for the souls of her children. And my grandma used to scare us with stories of La Llorona. And she would say, if you don't behave, La Llorona's going to come take you away. But to me, there was something more powerful than La Llorona, and it was a power that took away parents, not children, and that was the United States.
Right.
And the United States was this powerful thing that had taken my father when I was 2, and when I was 4 and a half, it also took away my mother. So I always saw it as this very powerful being, and that it took away parents, and it was a place that parents went to and that they hardly ever came back from.
Talk about that experience, being literally left behind by your parents who went to the United States and growing up in Mexico before you immigrated. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, well, you know, recently the Pew Hispanic Center released a study that showed that the largest wave of immigration from Mexico has come to a standstill. And this wave lasted 40 years, and it began in the 70s. And this is the context of my own family's immigration. My father left in 1977 when I was 2. And he came out here not to stay permanently. He just came to make some money so that he could build us a house in Mexico. And things didn't go, you know, that well for him. So he decided to send for my mother so that she could also come here and work and help him to make that money he needed for the house. So she came out here and she left us behind in Mexico with my paternal grandmother. So my siblings and I grew up without both our parents in a household where we were not wanted. And I think that's what made it worse. You know, it was bad enough that we didn't have both our parents, but it was worse to be left in a house where we were not wanted.
You were looked at as a burden.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, treated like a burden. And then my grandmother, she used to spend the money that my parents would send for us. She would spend it. So we were worse off than the kids who actually had both parents with them. And the neighbors used to call us the little orphans. And so, you know, looking back, I would say that my childhood was defined by my parents' absence, and it was defined by fear. I was so afraid. Every day of my life, I was afraid that I would never see them again. I was afraid that either something would happen to them or that they would forget about me and not come back for me. So definitely growing up like that, you know, it scars you and it leaves you with so many open wounds. So for me, writing about this experience was very healing because it really helped me to understand my circumstances a little better. And as I was writing about my parents, as a writer, I had to look at them the way I would look at any character. You know, I had to see them through different angles, look at their childhoods, look at what fears they had, what dreams they had, what were the circumstances that determined the choices that they made. And as I was writing the memoir, I really did come to a closer understanding of who they were and why they did what they did. And I can appreciate now those choices, you know, because the choice that my father made to come to the U.S. and then later to bring me here, it completely changed my life. And I wouldn't be here now where I am in terms of my career, in terms of the things I've been able to accomplish, if he hadn't made that choice to leave.
Speaking of which, your father bringing you to the other side, your memoir is called The Distance Between Us, him sort of closing that distance between you and him and your siblings. Talk about the circumstances under which you came to the United States. Set the scene for us.
Well, so my father had come here to build us a house, and he did manage to build us this house. But what happened was that the family that I had in Mexico broke up pretty much. Ironically, my mother came here to be with him because she wanted to save her marriage. So she left her children in Mexico to follow her husband north, and he left her for another woman when she got here. So he ended up getting together with another woman, and eventually my mother also remarried. So when my father came back to Mexico, he had built us a house, but we never lived in it. And the economy in Mexico had worsened. In 82, the peso was devalued 3 times that year. And my father had found a very, you know, a good job, a good stable job in L.A., and he didn't want to give that up. So instead of him coming back to Mexico, he decided to bring us back. And at first, he didn't want to bring me because I was 9 and a half and we were going to have to cross the border illegally. And he thought that I wouldn't make the journey because I was too young. And I begged him to bring me here, and we finally convinced him to bring me. So when we crossed the border, it was through Tijuana. And he was right. You know, we got caught the first 2 times by Border Patrol. And then the 3rd time, we tried it at night. And I remember just walking through this darkness and tripping on rocks, and I was just following them. One of the most vivid things I remember is when the helicopter showed up and we had to run for our lives and try to hide from the searchlight. And it was definitely a very hard experience, but you know, I was 9 and a half and I didn't really understand the extent of the danger that we were in. You know, I didn't know about all the immigrants that had lost their life or have been losing their lives since then. I didn't know that we were breaking laws, you know, that what we were doing was illegal. I just wanted to have a father, and I hadn't had a father for 8 years. And in order for me to have my father, I had to run across the border.
Most people think about immigration in broad political terms, as we talked about earlier in this conversation. But down by Tijuana, where you crossed, you literally see signs on the freeway of families grabbing a small child, as in, watch out for people crossing the street as they're coming into America, almost like deer's crossing. That's the sort of scene that you think about when you read your account of coming in across the border and getting caught. And when you hear about your account again in this conversation, you think about that human toll. What were your thoughts when you guys finally made it?
When we finally made it, I was just so happy to finally have closed that distance between me and my father. You know, those 2,000 miles were no longer between us. And it's interesting what you're saying about that sign, because, yeah, you see it off the 5 freeway. And that's exactly, that was us. You know, we had to cross from one side of the freeway to the other. And my dad was pulling me like the way you see in the sign. And he had to like throw me over that divider so we could get to the other side of the 5 freeway.
With oncoming traffic.
Right. Yeah. Right. And but I do remember, you know, to me it was like I can finally have my dad. I can finally start at least having some kind of family that I didn't have before. So it was a very exciting moment for me. It was also, you know, touching upon the title of the book, The Distance Between Us. It was also very heartbreaking not long after having crossed the border, because even though we had crossed the physical distance and we had closed up that gap, there was still a lot of other distances, you know, like there was an emotional distance that was created by the 8 years of separation. Meeting my father was really like meeting a complete stranger, because he left when I was 2. I had absolutely no memories of him. So when I came to live with him in LA, he was a stranger to me, and I had to get to know him. And then it was hard for him too, because he hadn't had to be a father for 8 years. And when he left us in Mexico, we were, you know, these little kids, and all of a sudden my siblings were already teenagers, you know, when we came here. So I know that it was hard for him. And then, you know, we had a stepmother who also was not very happy about being stuck with 3 children to raise. There was a lot of stuff going on at home that we quickly realized that even though those 2,000 miles were not between us anymore, there was a whole lot of other stuff in between that we had to try to overcome if we were ever going to have a good relationship with my father.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest today is Reina Grande. The Distance Between Us is the name of her memoir, a very harrowing and inspirational account of coming from Mexico, immigrating from Mexico to the United States. What was your impression of the United States as a kid once you got here? Reina, you're here, you're running across freeways, you're dodging helicopters and border patrol. You finally get here. What's your impression?
Well, I mean, it was definitely like being in heaven, because, you know, I grew up in this little town in Mexico. We had dirt floors, dirt roads, no running water, unstable electricity. I lived in this little shack made of bamboo sticks and cardboard. And then here I come to this country where the roads just seem to never end, and the buildings seem to reach the sky, and everything is just so, so beautiful and clean. And it was definitely an amazing experience. And one of the things that I really liked about where we ended up in LA was that we were very close to the mountains there, you know, the San Gabriel Mountains. And at least that gave me a little bit of a familiar thing to look at. You know, like in my hometown, we had a lot of mountains there to look at. So that was a very familiar thing. But yeah, and this was, you know, when we got here, my father took us to Payless and bought us our very first pair of tennis shoes, because in Mexico, all we had were little plastic sandals to wear. So I remember having a hard time adjusting to wearing tennis shoes for the first time. And we finally had a shower, and we had a toilet that flushed. And it was a very different experience. But one of the things that I remember the most when I, you know, started school was that the most shocking thing for me in terms of culture shock was walking into my classroom. And most of the students look just like me. You know, they have brown skin, black hair, brown eyes, and their last names were Gonzalez, Garcia, Hernandez. And they all looked exactly like me, but they could all speak a language that I couldn't speak.
And you were in the ESL program, English as a Second Language.
Yes.
How did that work?
It was very hard at first, because my elementary school did not have ESL. So basically, when I walked into the classroom, the teacher just pointed to a table in the corner and said, that's where you're going to be.
Wow.
And that's where I was for 2 years, 5th and 6th grade. I spent them there at the table by the corner with my teacher's assistant. And then when I went to middle school, we had ESL there. So when I started 7th grade, I was in intermediate ESL. And I was in a room with all the other students who were also English learners. So I didn't feel out of place in my ESL classes there.
You talk about in your book some of the informal ways on which you adapted the English language. Talk about that.
Informal ways in which I adapted?
Learning English outside of the classroom.
Well, one of the things that I did, you know, was I started reading a lot. And I, at first, of course, I could not really read that well. I was reading like the spot books, you know, and I was looking at pictures most of the time because I couldn't understand the words. But little by little, I started to understand more and more. So then by the time I got to middle school, I used to go to the public library every Friday to check out like 10 books and read them over the weekend. And I was reading books like Sweet Valley High and The Babysitter's Club. And it was very strange to be reading these books because the world in those books was so different from my own experiences. So in many ways, I felt like I couldn't quite connect to what I was reading. But at the same time, it gave me insight into a different kind of way of life in this country. But I fell in love with books. And I think that that's what really led me to also become a writer.
And speaking of your other learning experience, there are characters that figure prominently in this book, Carlos and Mago. Tell us about Carlos and Mago.
Carlos and Mago are my older siblings. Mago is her real name is Magloria, but we always called her Mago. And she's 4.5 years older than me. When my mother left, she asked my sister to take care of us. And my sister rose up to the challenge and she became my little mother. And Carlos was he's my brother. He's 2 years older than me. And as we were growing up in Mexico, you know, we both looked up to Mago because she was our little mother and she took care of us and she protected us in many ways. And it was really interesting because once we came to the U.S., you know, Carlos kind of started to seek his own independence. But my relationship with my sister was very strong, and I always looked up to her. And she was my protector. And there came a point in my life when I was 17 when she left home. And that was so devastating to lose her because, you know, I had lost my real mother, and now I was losing my little mother. And when she left to go in search of her own dreams, it was very devastating.
That's sort of definitely skipping ahead here to the complicated situation under which Mago moved out. And you had a serious conflict with your dad during that situation, a very harrowing scene.
Yes.
As Mago was leaving. Tell us about that and the circumstances under which she left.
Okay. Yeah, Mago was my father's favorite because she was the oldest and she looked like him. And my dad always called her mi negra. And he had a lot of high hopes for her. And then, you know, she went through a lot of difficulties and eventually she ended up dropping out of college, which disappointed my father a lot. And then she decided to leave home because she wanted her independence. And my father was a very difficult man to live with. So I don't blame her for wanting to leave. But so when she left, my father was so upset because my brother, Carlos, had also left home. He had gotten married at 20 against my father's wishes. So when my sister left, I had, you know, I was about to graduate from high school, and I had been accepted into UC Irvine to transfer there after high school. And my father was so devastated about my sister leaving that he didn't let me go to university. And he told me that I was going to be a failure, like my siblings. And he was so upset about Mago leaving, he wouldn't let me go see her. So I spent, you know, the whole summer without my sister. And I remember, and I didn't put it in the book, but even, you know, there was when prom came around and she actually had to sneak she parked at the alley by the house so that she could get me ready. And she got me ready in the car in this alley that stank of pee and everything. But
wow.
But because my dad would not let her come to the house and he would not let me see her. And then there came a point when she said, well, you know, forget him. I'm going to go pick you up. You tell him that I'm going to go pick you up. And when I told him that, he was very upset, and he told me, you can't go anywhere. You're not going to go. And he ended up beating me up really badly.
He's literally physically beating on you, and you're calling for your sister.
Yeah.
You're calling your sister's name, Mago, mm-hmm. Mago, Mago. She's not coming. Part of the reason was because she was with child mm-hmm. at the time, and they explained to you that perhaps had she been there,
yes,
she might have been in danger of losing her child. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So talk about the mental anguish of that.
Well, I mean, definitely, I think that was the moment, my lowest moment, you know, of my life up to that point was when my father was beating me up and I was calling my sister and she was not coming to rescue me. And I understood at that moment when she didn't come how alone I was. And it was a very, very painful moment to know that I couldn't count on her anymore, that she really was gone now. And I understood, you know, because she was pregnant, and I know that who knows what my dad would have done to her if she had come to my rescue. So I do understand that. But definitely at that moment, you know, when I'm 17 and my father's beating me up and I'm calling for my sister and she's not coming, I just felt so completely alone in this world. But when I look back at that moment, I realized that it was something that really needed to happen for me, because I don't think I would have ever learned to look out for myself.
Right, because jumping forward to make matters worse, because you were only 17, you needed your father's permission, both from a documentation standpoint and financially, mm-hmm. to secure your admission into UC Irvine.
Right.
And so what happened?
Well, what happened was that I spent the rest of that year wallowing in misery. I was
locked
in my bedroom. I wouldn't come out. I was so afraid of my father. And I developed this like really weird survival skills. But I, you know, it was, I was just feeling very, very low at that point. And there came a point when I realized that I couldn't wallow in my misery anymore, that I couldn't let my dream of going to college escape from me. So I decided to you know, take a stand, and I told my dad, I'm going to go enroll myself at community college. And he was okay with that. And I think it was because of that beating that he gave me. He knew that it had gone beyond anything, you know, that he had ever done to me. So he let me go. He didn't put up a fight or anything. And I started going to Pasadena City College. And that was really, you know, wonderful for me to be able to finally get out of my room where I had locked myself in for 6 months, to finally go out and start fighting for my dreams of getting an education.
And it was at Pasadena City College where you actually end up finding for the first time your writing voice.
Yes.
Tell us about that situation.
Yeah, when I got to PCC, I had been writing since eighth grade. You know, I like to write stories, but I never saw myself as a writer. So I got to PCC and I wanted to be an art major because I love to paint. And I was taking art classes there, and that's what I wanted to do. But then I met this teacher in my English class. And when I started taking her class, I would write, she would have us write essays. And I would always turn in short stories. And she would say, you know, you need to write your essays, but you're such a great writer. And she would always tell me that and write that on my paper. She would always say, you're such a great writer. But I still didn't think of myself as being a writer, becoming a writer. And what happened with this teacher was that, you know, when I met her, things at home were really bad. My dad had become, you know, his alcoholism had just gotten out of hand, and he was very violent, and he started also hitting my stepmother. So he ended up getting arrested for spousal abuse. And I was 19 years old, and I was, you know, I was so devastated with my father being arrested. So I went to look for my teacher, and I told her about what had happened. And then she said, you come live with me. She said, I don't want you to be dealing with those problems at home, because what you really need to be doing is focusing on your school. So she opened her home to me, and I went home and I packed my stuff, and then I went to live with my English teacher, which was just totally amazing. You know, I never expected that. And while I was living in her home, the first night that I stayed in her home, she gave me a book called The House on Mango Street. And I had never heard of Sandra Cisneros. I hadn't been reading Latino literature. And when she handed me The House on Mango Street, it was such an eye-opening moment for me, because this was, you know, when I read that book, I suddenly realized why she was telling me that I should be a writer. And just seeing people like me in a book.
Right. You realize, you know, at that point that there were lives and experiences and points of view that mirrored your own.
Right, right. And the fact that it was, you know, that's when I realized that Latinos do write books. And that I could write a book.
That, right.
Yep.
Our guest is Reina Grande. Her book is The Distance Between Us. She's a novelist, but this book is a memoir about her immigration from Mexico to California, from Mexico to El Otro Lado, the other side, literally and figuratively, in her journey from Mexico to the United States. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more on her life and on reconciling with her father and with her story. We'll be right back. And joining us once again is Reina Grande in the second half of this program. Her book is The Distance Between Us. Reina Grande, the direct translation is Big Queen. And if you read this story of immigration from Mexico to the United States, you understand why that name fits. It's an incredible journey into adulthood and America as well. Now, we talked about how you ended up at Pasadena City College, went to live with your English teacher, and from there, UC Santa Cruz, you originally denied the ability to go to UC Irvine because of conflicts with your dad. You decide to leave the LA area and go up to the Central Coast. Yeah. Why did you choose UC Santa Cruz?
It was the recommendation by my English teacher. I actually got accepted into UCLA as well, and I was going to go to UCLA. And then she said, you know, everybody plus their brother wants to go to UCLA. If you go there, you're just going to be one of thousands. But if you go to Santa Cruz, you know, it's a smaller school, and I think that'll be better for you. And also, you know, she was encouraging me to leave LA because she said, you'll never become independent if you don't step out of your comfort zone. But yeah, so she encouraged me to go to UC Santa Cruz, and that's where I went. And it was the most wonderful thing ever because, you know, leaving L.A., the only place I had ever known besides my hometown in Mexico, it was a wonderful experience to actually go and experience something completely different and new.
And it is completely different up there. Your mascot is banana slugs.
Yes.
For God's sake.
They're the slugs.
Talk about gaining your independence from moving away from home and what you learned up in Santa Cruz.
Well, Santa Cruz, you know, the university was built in a redwood forest, which is really wonderful. Such a difference from LA, where, you know, there's no nature there in LA and hardly any trees. And then I go to Santa Cruz and the whole campus is in a forest. And as I was walking to my classes, I would pass by deer, you know, that were walking around. Yeah. And it was just so, so wonderful to be immersed in nature. And for someone like me who had so many emotional wounds, it was a wonderful place to heal. And I found myself there. And then one of the best things about being in Santa Cruz was that, you know, I got to stay at the student housing. And this was, besides my teacher's house where I had lived, this was the first time when I could actually step out of my room and not be afraid of someone yelling at me or hitting me or putting me down. And that was very healing for me. And then the campus, you know, it was such a great experience being a student there because I got a lot of support from campus. I got a $1,000 grant to self-publish a collection of short stories that I had written. I got a grant to go back to Mexico to do some research and visit my relatives. I had, you know, the very first semester was kind of hard for me because I did feel a little out of place. Usually I was the only Latina student in my class. And the writing that I was doing, you know, all my writing has been very autobiographical. So I was writing about my experience of poverty in Mexico, of walking around barefoot, not having enough to eat. And my teacher was so out of touch with that experience that she would tell me, "You're just making it up."
And then for authenticity, you also use a lot of Spanglish.
Right.
A lot of Spanglish.
Right, so right.
That must have been a little bit foreign to them as well.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and the stuff they were writing about was very foreign to me. So that was my first experience there in Santa Cruz. But overall, I had some really good teachers there that were very supportive. And that was also the place when I actually got in touch with my Latino heritage. Because, you know, when I came to this country, I was so absorbed with learning English and trying to fit in that I sacrificed my Spanish language. And when I got to Santa Cruz, I was actually the writing tutor. That was my job. And I had learned English so well that I was tutoring students who were born in this country who only spoke English. I was teaching them how to write English well.
Wow.
And how to write good essays. And but I had sacrificed my Spanish for that. And when I was in Santa Cruz, I realized that I needed to take it back. And Santa Cruz had classes. It was Spanish for Spanish speakers. And that's when I started to relearn my native tongue. You know, I learned a lot of Spanish while I was there. And there were, you know, some Latino groups on campus, like Latino organizations that I joined. So I started to take back my Latino-ness.
Right.
And I was very happy about that.
Talk about getting along the path of U.S. citizenship.
We came in 1985 with my father, and he had been here since 77. And then in 1986, the Reagan administration approved an amnesty that legalized 2.9 million people. So my father was one of those people that got their green cards. And we got our green cards as well. By the time I was in ninth grade, I got my green card. So for 5 years, we lived here. You know, we were undocumented. And there was definitely that fear of living in the shadows, of not having the opportunities that we wish we had. But my father always said, you know, just because we're illegal, it doesn't mean we can't dream. So we still dreamed. You know, we dreamed of a better future. And then when we got our green cards, the world just opened up to us. And I took my green card and I ran with it, you know, and I did all the things I wanted to do.
And that's not a typical story of an immigrant, no matter where you're from.
Right. Especially nowadays.
Right. And you sort of gotten the sort of wave of history sort of slid in your favor
right.
with that
yeah.
as well along that time in history.
Yeah. And it hasn't repeated, which is a shame, you know, because there's so many kids nowadays, young people that have not had that opportunity that I had and who have the same dreams, you know, who want to better themselves, who want to give back to society, and they're unable to do it because they don't have that green card. And it's been very hard. You know, immigration has become such a controversial topic that politicians don't want to touch it. And definitely after 9/11, you know, the immigrant population here really suffered from that moment in time.
And there's a sense, too, that they're all brown. So
yes.
Arabs can be Mexican, Mexicans can be Arab. To a small-minded immigration official or a politician trying to make their bones on immigration as an issue.
Right, right. And that's a real shame, you know, because right before 9/11, President Bush was having talks about immigration reform, you know, having guest worker programs. He had a really good relationship with the Mexican president
Vicente Fox. Yeah.
So they were having dialogue about, you know, how to address the issue of immigration. And he was very open, you know, to working things out. And then 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden, nobody wants to talk about immigration anymore, immigration reform. And it's all been like all this anti-immigrant.
And if they do want to talk about it, it's from a patriot.
Right. And it's all about closing the borders, you know, doing this, doing that. And they haven't had that dialogue again about how to help the immigrants that are here in this country. So one of the things for me that's really pressing is the DREAM Act. You know, it hasn't passed. I think it should. I'm a big supporter of the DREAM Act. I really, really think that, you know, these young people that we have right now who are fighting to get ahead in life and to be able to contribute to society, we should allow them, you know, that opportunity to legalize their status and to allow them, you know, to make their dreams a reality.
The DREAM Act does sort of soften the blow for immigrants looking to make their way peacefully and within the confines
and,
of the law.
And it addresses the situation of people like me who were brought here as children by their parents. And, you know, just like I came here when I was 9 and a half, a lot of them were brought here even younger than that. You know, this is the only country that they've known. So they're just like, you know, President Obama said they're Americans in all ways except for one, which is on paper. And so I can completely relate to that, you know, because like I said, like my English became my dominant language. And I've been in the U.S. for 27 years, and I've only spent 9 years in Mexico. So in many ways, I am more American, you know. It's a hard place to be stuck in, you know, when you're that 1.5 generation, like the Dreamers, like myself. Because even though I was born in Mexico, when I go back, I'm not Mexican enough, even though I was born there. And then being here, even though I lived in this country for most of my life, I'm not American enough because I was born in Mexico. So it's a very hard place to be in when you're not Mexican enough or American enough. So it's like, what are you?
Speaking of which, in examining those two worlds, what would you say is sort of the state of the literary community as a Latina? What are the conversations that are being had today?
Well, it's an interesting place to be in right now because one of the things that, you know, I mean, let me tell you a little bit about being a Latina writer, you know, because it's very interesting to be a Latina writer in the U.S. versus being a Latina writer like in Latin America,
right,
for example. And I didn't quite know this, like I haven't seen it firsthand until very recently. A year ago, I went to South Korea for a literary conference, and it was a conference for Asian, African, and Latin American literature. And I thought that they were inviting me because I was from Mexico, so I was going to go represent Mexico, you know, being part of Latin America. And when I got there, I discovered that they had their writer from Mexico, and they had a writer from Argentina. And they listed all the authors and their countries right next to them. And when it came to my name, they put Reina Grande Latino. And I said,
wrong masculine tense,
and
first
I
of
said,
all.
Yeah. And then I said, well, what happened to my country?
Right.
And they said, well, you know, we couldn't give you Mexico. Because even though you were born there, you haven't lived there in years,
wow,
and you're not really a Mexican writer. And we couldn't give you the U.S. because even though you live there, you weren't born there. So you're not really an American writer. So you're a Latino writer.
So did they give you La Frontera?
Yeah, they should have put La Frontera there. So they gave me Latino as my country.
Wow. Wow. And what do you think about that? That's an interesting thing, too. Especially in an area of the country like this, people tend to group Latinos together. I don't know if you're familiar with our local community here, a very rich community of Mexican Americans going all the way back even to the 19th century here in Kansas City and Kansas City, Kansas.
Right, right.
But outside of the community, they tend to lump, whether it's El Salvador, whether it's Mexico, whether it's República Dominicana, all of it, all together, just Latino.
We're all Latinos. Yeah, and you know, that creates a problem too, because I think that's why we're not as unified as we should be. Because even though, you know, we are lumped together, but we're different in many ways. But I think that we need to embrace that, you know, to feel as one people, even if we are, you know, coming from different countries. We do have a lot of commonalities. And I think if we did embrace that, I think it would be a lot better in terms of being, you know, more united and being able to fight for our rights.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Reina Grande. The Distance Between Us is the name of her book, a memoir about coming from Mexico to the United States. Bringing you back to the book and how it concludes, you're reconciling with your father essentially on his deathbed. Talk about that.
Yeah, my father got diagnosed with liver cancer when I was writing the second half of the book, which is all about him. And that made the writing very hard, because I was writing about a moment in his life and my life when things were very different. You know, as I mentioned earlier, my father, he suffered from alcohol abuse. And when I was growing up with him as a teenager, you know, I suffered a lot of physical abuse from him because of his alcoholism. So when I was writing the memoir and I'm going back to this moment in my life, in my teenage years, and then he gets diagnosed with liver cancer, it was very hard to deal with it, because I was bringing up all these feelings that I had buried inside me, writing about things that I didn't want to think about. And then I would have to go see him at the hospital. And I had to tell myself, this is not the same father that you've been writing about all day. You know, this is a different father. So that was very hard. But one of the things that I touch upon in the book on his death is that, you know, I had lost my father so many times.
You call him the man behind the glass.
Right. And I called him the man behind the glass because for the 8 years that he was gone from my life, I only knew him through a photograph that we had framed and hanging on the wall. But I lost my father to the U.S. I lost my father to alcoholism. I lost my father to my stepmother. I lost my father to so many things. And then here I am, you know, in the hospital on his deathbed, and I'm losing him again. And this time it's a final kind of loss, you know. And I knew that. And the difference was that all the other times I had lost my father, there was always the hope that he would come back to me. And then this time he's on his deathbed, and I know that I'm not going to get him back anymore, that there is no hope. But when he died, I decided that I was going to let all the negative stuff die with him, and that I was only going to hold on to all the positive things that he taught me, that he gave me. So that was, in a way, a healing moment for me to finally accept that I could hold on to his memory, even though I was losing him.
Why did you choose to put that toward the end? It could have gone anywhere. Why did you choose to put that toward the end?
Because to me, that was like the closing of this episode in my life. And because I had so many conflicted emotions about my father, but the moment of his death, it was a moment when I finally let all of that go. And I really felt like a different person after he died. And you know, you can't be angry at a dead person, because if you are, you're just hurting yourself.
As you go around on this book tour and you visit different areas around the country, what would you say your central message about the misconception around immigrants is? What people don't know about immigrants?
Well, I think sometimes people think that immigrants just wake up one day and say, oh, I'm going to go to the U.S. and then they leave, you know? And it's not like that at all. It's such a difficult choice to make. It's definitely, you know, it's a choice that's born out of necessity, you know, that they feel that they don't have a whole lot of options. And when your children are starving, you don't have a lot of options and you cannot wait. A lot of people say, well, what can they wait for? A visa so they can come legally. And it's like, it's nearly impossible to get a visa. And then you have to wait forever to get a visa. And a lot of these people that are in desperate need, they can't even qualify to get a visa because they don't even have something as basic as a bank account. So I guess one of the things that I want to address in my books is that, you know, this complexity of immigration and what goes into making that decision to immigrate. And I would really love to see immigration being a choice, not a necessity.
What would you say is the prescription for your home country of Mexico to make a better way at home so that it then becomes a choice?
Oh, they said that.
It's a big question.
Right? They said that the big question. Yes, definitely. I mean, I think the government.
Pregunta grande.
Yeah, la pregunta grande. You know that I think that definitely the Mexican government needs to take more action to make sure that people don't have that need to leave. I think one of the arguments have been that the government hasn't really done a whole lot about this immigration because they benefit from it. You know, I mean, look how much money immigrants send into the country. I think it's their largest revenue, the second largest revenue besides oil. So, of course, they're not going to do anything about people leaving because they're sending all this money back. And they're benefiting from it. But I do think they need to take more responsibility of, you know, providing more jobs, more opportunities for people. And I think we're seeing that, you know, there's been a big change in Mexico. I think people are finding more opportunities. And I think things are changing. So that's really good. You know, good to know that.
We've been answering the Pregunta Grandes, the big questions, with the big queen, Reina Grande, here on Central Standard. Her book is called The Distance Between Us. She's been a delightful guest here today on the program. It's a memoir about her journey from Mexico to the United States and what ensues after that. A great book, a great story. Thank you for coming to Central Standard today and sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And tune in tomorrow as we take another look at art therapy, plus... Are books doomed for extinction? Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is next with a talk about the latest trends in brain health. How fit is your brain? I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.